Joining me now for our January edition of Our Town, and it is a brand new year. Senator Arne Roblin has stopped in and agreed to sit down with me today. How are you doing?
Doing well, thank you.
The wet weather it's kind of expected this time of year.
It is expected, and it's interesting. I had some friends, a senator, who asked me if her son coming home from college was going to go camping in the Coast Range, and I said, testing time to go camping in the Coast Range.
I think he
changed his plans after the storm started.
So. Make sure you wear some wet weather gear.
Exactly.
For sure. Did you just come back from Salem? Is that where you were?
Yes, I was in Salem for some meetings yesterday afternoon and today.
Because that's not usually, that's not a real easy drive.
No, I have to go back again this week, too. It's one of those weeks.
So 2019, a lot of bills passed, a lot of different changes. I'm just going to hit a couple of these that I noted down, and you can talk about these or talk about some other ones if you want. Free college tuition for foster children in the system that no longer have to also do community service. That was one that's passed. That was House Bill 4014. 4145 bans guns to those who've been convicted of domestic abuse. Tougher hit and run laws. I don't have that particular bill there. Single-use plastics ban. Bill 2509 and Senate Bill 998, rolling stops for bicycles. That was just a few of the things that people that I've heard talking about recently. Pretty typical year, though, as far as things getting passed.
Yeah, actually very, very typical. It didn't end typically because my Republican colleagues chose to leave before the session got over because of the cap and trade bill, and they didn't come back to the last day or two, I guess 2 days. Those last 2 days saw us pass about 130 bills. So, I mean, a lot happened in those last 2 days. It's hard to keep imagining. But the House had been working, and so they were all stacked up, ready to go.
So was that the biggest stickler then? Obviously, the cap and trade was the biggest stickler, but pretty much everything else was kind of bipartisan.
There were two or three.
Bipartisan.
Cap and trade was the big one. They left for a couple of days earlier in the session around funding for the student success bill that I was intimately involved with. Getting funding for schools has been a priority of mine since I got in the legislature. We finally got that done. This new bill, the new tax takes effect on the 1st of January, so it just went in. And it'll raise about $1 billion a year for schools, $2 billion a biennium. That brings it almost up to what we had anticipated paying back in the 90s when we passed a bill by the Republicans at the time saying that the quality education model is the way we should plan on funding schools. And we've been a couple $1 billion short ever since the early 2000s in funding schools. So puts us back in the middle of the pack with respect to state funding for K-12 education.
Now, is a lot of that funding going toward the individual structures? Is it going for teacher salaries? Is it going for supplemental things that teachers need?
So as people don't always remember, Oregon is interesting in our education funding. 197 school districts. Everyone has a board. They have exclusive rights on how they spend their money. So the state will give them money, 50% of that, $500 million a year, for them to implement the kinds of plans they want to implement. We have suggestions and some other things that are expectations that they need to improve graduation rates. They need to improve attendance. We have these bigger goals that they have to work on.
And if they meet
and they have to show a plan about how they're going to go do that. Mm-hmm. But they can figure out what that plan is. They can figure out how they're going to spend that money. So some will use it on class size. Some will use it for vocational programs more exclusively than others. That is a part of the bill as well to finish up funding for those new vocational programs we've put in place. They might say we need to make sure that we have activities like 4-H, Future Farmers of America, Business Leaders of America. There's a whole bunch of those organizations that have school components as well as others, and they might say there is really good evidence that says if kids are engaged in those activities, they graduate at about 95% graduation rate. So how do we get more kids engaged in those kinds of activities? So there's a lot of opportunity for school districts to make decisions about how they're going to go about doing it.
Will this, misheard you, will this also include like technical programs and things like that?
Yeah, I mean,
skills.
We made a separate part that says we will fully fund Measure 30, I can't remember the number now, 98, which had to do with putting vocational classes back in schools and classrooms.
Because that seems to be, when I was going to college, I was thinking, you know, I'm going to have this great degree and I'm going to use it for this, that, and the other thing. And it turns out that, I would have been much better you know, getting my plumber's license, you know, back then as far as the dollar for dollar value of it, you know.
Yeah, my dad was a carpenter and a trainer for apprentices. So, I mean, I always had that opportunity and look back at that and recognize that you go right out of high school, you get an apprenticeship program in carpentry, you could do really well. My brother, my cousin, who I grew up with, his dad was an electrician, and he became an electrician. He's had a great life and made good money and
welders too.
Welders are doing exceptionally well right now. Yeah. So, you know, finding a good vocation is a really important aspect in people's choices as they move through. But making sure that we have those opportunities so that kids, you don't have to grow up in a carpenter's family to become a carpenter because you've had some experiences at the school would be really helpful.
Well, I'm glad I didn't continue in my family's. My dad was a restaurateur, and that was something that, you know, led to an early demise for him. And I didn't want to be part of that, you know, education.
It's a tough business.
It is a tough
business. And a lot of people don't recognize, you know, they see the glitziness of it as they come into the restaurant and have the dinner and all that kind of stuff. And they think, boy, I could cook this dinner cheaper. And then they don't realize, yeah, but you don't have to pay the cook and the bottle washer and the server and all these other people, as well as buy the products and recognize that part of the stuff you're buying is waste, is going to go other places. So you're not getting any value for some of the things you're buying. It's a big business. It's a tough business. You have to have a good head on your shoulders to make that work.
When you have the fast food portion of it, which is just about getting food. Then you have what I consider the luxury dinner, which is where you're going out to be waited on, to be taken care of, and you are spending the money for that.
Yes.
I mean, having been in the restaurant business, I can so much appreciate sitting down at a dinner table and having someone wait on me.
Isn't that true? I agree.
Yeah. All right. So,
going back to your list.
Now, as a cyclist,
right?
I love the fact of the rolling stop. As a motorist, I don't know that I'm all that.
We've done it. There's been a lot of studies done, and places like Idaho and others have had it for a while. So the question was, is it safer or less safe? And the reality from all the information we kept getting was that when a bicyclist has to stop and lean over on his bike and then get started again, that creates much more problems than if they have good vision, they're driving at a reasonable space, they look, they slow down, they make sure and they just keep on going, is much safer in the long run than having that sudden stop. Figure out where you're going. You know, with cleats on bicycles, sometimes you can't even stop. So how do you figure out how to do all those things? We're wait and see. Part of the bill and part of the conversation was that we will keep tracking that, and ODOT will tell us whether there's more or less or whatever accidents caused by that kind of stuff. But I think the indications were from every place that is doing it already that it seems to keep traffic flowing better.
And again, it's a team effort. It's an effort between the motorist and the cyclist, you know, to know. I mean, because you get a motorist that's coming down a side street that's a slower street, but they're doing exceeding the speed limit.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be really careful.
Yes, you
that,
do. And bicyclists, for the most part, know that they are the ones at risk.
Right. Yeah,
they lose. In the collision, they generally lose. Yes. Foster children, that's been a really big conversation at the legislature the last number of years.
Because they don't seem to have the opportunities that some in a...
30% of foster kids graduate.
Wow. That's a low...
Low number.
Yeah.
And of those, 10 or 15% get through college. So foster kids come to the table with a lot less. And when they turn 18, even if they're still in school, oftentimes the family that's raising them is not going to get resources from the state, so they are sent off on their own. And that means that some of them can't find a place or a couch to sleep on, so they don't graduate. And then they don't have any other resources from family or others to go on to college. So getting through the paperwork that it takes to get those kinds of things is really tough. So what we're trying to do is expedite the ability for those kids who are bright, have just as much personal skills to be a successful college student, to take away some of the issues that prevent them,
handicap them
in that deal. So that's our hope, and our goal is to have more and more of those kids see an opportunity for themselves in getting a college education and therefore raising their level in society.
Now, what is the overall secondary education system like for the state of Oregon for, say, those who may not be in that position? Are there opportunities for, you know, kids from regular families too?
So we have a number of programs right now that work for, in general. The one that was the most across the board program had to do with one we passed a couple of years ago. We've kind of made it a little bit more for moderate, medium income families and lower, and the highest when we were expecting. And that says that if you want to go to a community college, it's free tuition for any student who graduates from a high school in Oregon. It's patterned after a program in it's called Oregon Promise, and it's a program that was first developed in Tennessee. We have had really great results with that. The kids go to college, they go to the community college, they earn credits at the appropriate rate, and they move on at a better rate than the kids that didn't have that before. So we're hopeful. Actually, we had anticipated not as many of them would continue as they did, but they keep continuing, so we've had to find some more money to make sure that program is viable. But it's a fairly inexpensive way to keep kids in school and to make sure that all people in Oregon recognize that there's values in letting those people go on to college.
Now, as I understand it, too, the community colleges are also working on where a student can get a four-year degree now.
Yep, that was also approved. Most of those will be technical programs, so you can get a bachelor's of nursing instead of just a nursing license at community colleges. There'll be also degrees in other vocational areas that maybe the community college is better suited to do. But yes, there is an opportunity now for a four-year degree at a community college.
Wow.
And Southwestern down here in Coos Bay has had that for a while. They have a college partnership with Eastern Oregon University. And so we have a number of teachers that have gotten their degrees while staying in Coos Bay and going out to the Southwestern to get the college credits. Hmm. And just like our community colleges have courses in high school, so kids can come out of high school with credits. We're working those same things with the universities and the community colleges in cooperation to figure out similar things that they can do to help make geography not the problem for kids getting that next degree. And that's really is important.
That's good. What are some other things that you remember being a big deal in 2019?
So this one, plastics ban, you mentioned it there, the single-use plastics. There was also a straw ban. That didn't happen. So there were a lot of kinds of conversations about how do we improve the ecology. Plastic bags, when they're in the water out in the ocean, look like jellyfish to people, like little sea turtles. And our aquarium, we got some money for the aquarium to upgrade. And they also are the only place between Seattle and San Diego that can recuperate larger animals like sea lions and seabirds. They have a big recovery deal in the back. They get 10 to 12 turtles a year because the turtles swim up in the current that's been warm. They get off into our water and they get hypothermia. They end up on the beach. Someone says, we got this big sea turtle. What do I do with it? Take it to the aquarium and they try to recover, get them back, and then they fly them down to San Diego to put them in water where they
warmer,
belong.
Yeah.
So there's those kinds of things. The one that caused the most consternation from my Republican colleagues was the idea of 2020 was the name of the bill, and it had to do with cost of carbon. It was a program designed pretty much under the California plan of having cap and trade, which actually in its original form in California was really the proposal that was put forward by industry. So we worked on that. It did not pass. And so they're looking at I've been working with some other people. That's the reason I was up in Salem today, to see if there's a pathway forward for some similar but different bill. My biggest concern was whenever you put fuels into the mix, which California didn't do for about 8 years, that affects everybody. And people in rural areas have to drive a lot more. So if you raise costs on gasoline, it creates bigger problems for rural areas than it does for urban areas, where they have lots of choices. Get on a bus, take the rapid transit, do all those other kinds of things. So that was frustrating to me that we weren't having that conversation. This new bill looks at that in a very different way and actually says for rural areas, we shouldn't include gasoline prices at all. So in urban areas,
would that be for business and residential?
Anybody in rural area, their gas stations will not be charged extra.
Because I wonder what does a cap and trade bill do to an industry like logging here in our state, which has really gone down and kind of, you know, put a damper in a lot of the loggers and logging businesses. How does that affect?
You know, the if done correctly, it should not affect them much at all. They'll be paying similar costs to everybody else that's doing the different kinds of things. The possibility that they have is that because trees suck up a lot of carbon, They can gain some value from their forest in other ways. Then you have to worry about making sure there's enough supply of forest products for our mills to keep them working. So those are big, important deals. Plus, there's a lot of energy used by those sawmills and those others. Pulp mills use a lot of energy. So you have to make sure that you don't affect those prices in such a way that it puts them non-competitive with others. So there's a whole section in the bill that goes about making sure that they're kind of held harmless so they can continue to run and compete with the rest of the people in the world.
And how does how do the state and federal government work when it comes to that? Does the state have a lot of say over logging rights? I guess they don't in federal lands, I guess. Is that right?
That's right. And 51% of our state is owned by the federal government. So
can we get rid of them?
Lots of people have talked about
Right.
I just don't see that happening for very soon. But in the private lands, the state has a lot to say. I mean, we get engaged in lots of different conversations about forests. We do some things better than any place else in the world. We fight fires better than anywhere in the West, and they still cost us a lot of money. But because we are the only government in the world that gets a Lloyd's of London policy for fighting fires. So we pay them $5 million for a policy. They tell us that you pay the first $25 million, we'll pay the second $25 million for costs. And we have done pretty well with that ability to do that because we take fighting fires very seriously in the state of Oregon. The problem is the federal government doesn't see fighting fire the same way. So oftentimes we have to be right along the border of a federal forest to stop a fire from intruding into private funders. And we need to continue to work in better ways to cooperate with each other. And the federal government is starting to recognize that if they don't thin their forests, if they don't clean them out, all they are doing is making a hazard. And I think we're getting a little bit better cooperation with the federal government on that. And we need to keep pushing on that.
Keep our fingers crossed.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. So maybe a couple other things quickly. And let's see, 2020 coming up there. Legislative session starts
February, the first week of February, ends the first week and a half of March. So it's 35 days in the session. We'll have to wait and see. It's very fast. So every senator is given one bill. During the regular session, we can have as many bills as we want. During the special the short session, senators get one bill. House members get two bills. We don't know exactly why because they represent half as many people. It's just what they've
just
decided.
Strange, yeah.
And then committees get three bills. So there will be a much smaller section of bills that are out there.
What do you want to get accomplished in your final year here?
I have a number of things. I'm trying to figure out if we can weave this pattern to get some kind of carbon pricing policy out that works and cuts down on carbon and does the kinds of things that we as Oregonians think are important. I also have been given a new committee on mental health. Mental health is a big issue in our state, and we need to figure out what's going on. Since the 1970s, 60s and 70s, when we decided that we didn't want to house people in mental institutions, we've let them go, but we haven't really responded by having in place the kinds of services that those people need. And I think it's a big part of why we have a lot of homelessness right now and a lot of other kinds of issues, because we have people who, without some kind of assistance, they aren't going to be able to lead a productive life. So we're looking at those kinds of things. We're looking at workforce. How do we make sure we have enough people in the workforce in mental health to make those things work? There's a new group of clinics that are starting. We were one of a group of seven different states that got a federal program, which the federal government pays 75% of the cost. We pay 25%, where you take mental health and physical health and you put it together in the same clinic.
So yeah, I noticed that they've got a new Oregon Integrated Health
Care.
These
are even more than that one, but that's the whole idea of these deals. And we're getting the information and the studying them right now. We have a bill that will extend that process. We're hoping the federal government will continue to pay for that extension. And we didn't fund it last time. So they're in dire straits. They need about $15 million to continue the rest of this biennium before we start looking at where we go in the future. But the early indications are, and we're going to have a report to our committee next week, early indications are they are working very, very well, and they're solving problems that haven't been. And they work better in rural areas than they work in metropolitan areas. I went over to Baker City, over into eastern Oregon. I'm trying to remember the city right now, to look at one of the programs that are over there. They have their own ranch. They have these people out working and doing things, and they're having a lot of success with kids from all over the state that get housed in their facilities. So it's been interesting for me to get immersed in this mental health issue, so I will continue to work on that one. Ocean stuff, we passed 10 years ago now, the marine reserves. We've been studying them for a while. There's a requirement for a report on that. We didn't fund the report study. It's about $200,000. The universities have to look at it and put it all together. So we have a bill that includes that and some other kinds of things about ocean acidification, ocean hypoxia, about $1 million worth of requests. And we have an Ocean Science Trust, which I helped along with some other people to form a few years ago. And some money goes to there so that we can do the right research that we need to make sure we're doing the right things on the in the coast. So those are the biggies from my perspective for this session. And then making sure that the things that we set in motion last time, including the Student Success Act, are implemented appropriately and correctly. Working with school districts and others to make sure that happens.
How often does a bill go through, become law, and then not work out the way you thought it was going to?
You know, it's interesting you say that one, just because my very first session, the first bill we worked on was one of those. And you would probably remember it if you were around. It's been 16 years ago, but they passed a bill before I got there that said school zones will be 25 miles an hour, 24 hours a day. So if you're driving along Highway 101 in Coos Bay, coming into the city, all of a sudden you're going from 50 miles an hour to 25 miles an hour. They gave a lot of tickets in that area, especially in the middle of the night, because people said, what? There's no school at 2 o'clock right in the morning. And the only people that voted against it were police officers in the legislature who said, this isn't going to work, folks. And the next session, it was the first bill we took up, was saying, when the lights are flashing, you will go 25 miles an hour. But other than that, you can go the regular speed limit.
Right.
So there are times when our goal is to fix some things that we thought were good ideas before, safety or whatever. And the other thing is that we write a bill and then they have to implement it with rules. And the agency makes the rules separate from us. Sometimes the rules they make, we don't think truly represent what we were asking for. So we come back to fix some of those things as well.
I see that in federal politics all the time.
Yeah, it's all the time. So we're always looking at what we did in the past to see if it's moving forward in the right direction. And we're always about making corrections as time goes on. We can't be 100% accurate. Well, hopefully we're better than 50%. But the issue is you always have to watch and keep looking. And times change and things change. So some bill we thought was really important turns out not to be so important in the future. I think we're working really hard at getting electrification. So there's a whole bunch of bills out there that have to do with how we pay for roads, has to do with gas tax. You don't have vehicles using gas, you're going to have to do something to fix an old bill that in its time did a pretty good job. We are not collecting enough money from the gasoline tax to keep our roads repaired. And you can tell that when you drive on any road. So,
and the more battery-operated vehicles you have on the road,
the worse that becomes. So,
and of course, they've done a change for that, right, to adjust for the registration fees.
It turns out the adjustment was very short.
Minimal?
Minimal. It was not enough. So it's not filling up the trust fund the way we need it to if we really want to improve or keep our roads from falling apart. Mm-hmm. So those are the kinds of things that we will always have to keep working on as well.
I always thought that if our roads were impeccable and then you ask somebody to give you a few dollars to keep them that way, they might be more okay to do that than if they're bad and then we're waiting on money to fix them and then we think the money's there and they're still not getting fixed. So
that's true. No, I mean, it is really a dilemma for cities in particular, you know, to kind of keep their roads up. In eastern Oregon, there's a lot of counties that have gone back to gravel roads because gravel roads are much easier to keep up than our asphalt roads.
Well, and I've done some motorcycle riding in the eastern part of the state. I know how some of those roads are. Next thing you know, you're like in a bunch of divots going through the road.
That's right.
Yeah. But then you got something like Highway 101 here, which is, you know, a whole different thing altogether. Someone else has to take care of that. It goes right through the city here. It goes through Coos Bay. We have to depend on
The state has to take care of their state roads, and our federal government has to help with the federal roads. The problem with 101 is it's built on ground that should never be built on. we have a perpetual landslide down in by Curry County. You've got it's another one that's closed up by Newport, mm-hmm. so it's always get out
when
of
you
Newport.
You have the one by Sea Lion Cave. It's almost always
heading off into the ocean. Yeah. So we made a choice. Everybody loves 101, or I do. I love driving it in the mornings and seeing the crabbers out there and the lights in the ocean. Mm-hmm. But with that comes engineering problems that make it a hard road to keep up.
Yeah, it was more like a horse and buggy thing back in the day.
That's true.
Well, I appreciate you coming in. I know you've got about a year left. I hope it's not our last time we get to sit down. But in closing, is there anything else that you wanted to touch on?
No, I think, you know, it was frustrating to end the session the way we did last time with my colleagues leaving. And I talked to many of them in places where they were, in Idaho and Montana, and trying to get them to come back because there was a lot of stuff we needed to get done at the end. And some of them were really important for me. There was funding for the aquarium. There was funding for a dam up in Newport. There was a lot of different things that were left undone that we needed to get people back. I was very pleased that they came back and we got a lot of that work done. 90% of the bills that go through unanimously or with bipartisan support. We need to continue to work on that. I think that from my perspective, I wish there was more collegiality between the two parties and that people got along and had their cut discussions, because I think that when you truly open up to real discussions, the chances of getting a better bill that doesn't have unintended consequences becomes greater. And when one group decides this is the way it's going to be because we think it's the right way, you open yourselves up for those kinds of problems. And true collegiality, that doesn't mean that you agree. It means you fight it out on every little issue.
Right.
But you fight it out with an understanding that you're going to listen to each side and come up with solutions that'll work for a whole lot of people. And an understanding that people who live in real Eastern Oregon have different needs and understandings than the people who live in downtown Portland. Mm-hmm. And those of us on the coast have different needs and expectations than those people who live in the valley. So how do you keep those conversations alive, and how do we make sure that
you're not doing it all
people
just
are
for
listening? Right. People are listening. Because when it comes down to the population that votes for things, the valley controls Oregon. And Portland in particular has a big say in any of those elections. We're going to have redistricting coming up in the next session. So we're going to have to start having a conversation about what will these districts look like.
Is that going to be done by an independent group, or is that done by...
No, it's done by the legislature. Our Constitution requires the legislature to do it. And if they can't, it goes to the Secretary of State, who will then draw the lines. And that happened with Bill Bradbury. The last time it was done, I was co-speaker, and we actually did it in the legislature, both the federal and House redistricting all got done in-house, which hadn't happened in about 100 years. So it's not an easy task.
Rural lines aren't as
oh, we change more.
It's more diverse, isn't it, than, say in Portland Metro and
in
that
In Portland
area?
Metro, it may be a block that gets changed.
Yeah.
In ours, I got half of Tillamook County.
Well, there you go.
And I lost Charleston South, which was not a big part of my district. The new part I got, I gained extra counties besides Tillamook. I got parts of Yamhill and what's the other one up there? Polk counties are both. I think it's both.
But population-wise, did it change much?
Population has to stay the same. That's the federal constitutional requirement. Every Senate district has to have almost precisely the same number of people in it. Not
so
voters.
That's why they change
people.
It sometimes.
So that's why it has to be changed.
Because you have more people moving into an area. Yeah.
So you look at it and you watch the lines just kind of coalescing towards Portland, because that's where the population growth is. Or Bend is growing at a rate that. And this particular session, it is anticipated that Oregon will get one more federal representative.
Wow.
Because our population has grown that much.
Just over the last couple of years, looking at Bend, it's the way it's changing. It's amazing.
So that'll be a big conversation this next session as to how are we going to do this redistricting, and where is that new federal delegate going to go? Where is that House, that representative to the House, going to be seated, and whose districts are torn apart to make that happen? So that's all the kind of interesting things that will happen next session.
Thank you for coming in. Thank you for giving me your time. Appreciate it. Senator Arne Roblin, everybody. In the next hour of Our Town, we'll be talking with Dr. Mark Schnapper about measles. We'll also talk with Kirk Malenik and Rachel Pearson about the upcoming Winter Music Festival and what it's like to be a volunteer at Peace Health, Peace Harbor Medical Center. All in the next hour of Our Town.